It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with me next week. Coming up, we hear how an adventurous 19th century Wisconsin frontierswoman continues to teach us about life in the Northwest Territory. First, we're talking about proposed legislation that could affect how rideshare companies like Uber and Lyft would operate in Wisconsin. On Monday, State Representative Tyler August introduced a bill that would set minimum standards for these app-based rideshare companies. The bill also would block local governments from creating stricter regulations. Uber and Lyft have gained popularity by contracting ordinary people to shuttle customers around cheaply through a smartphone app. Critics of these services say that lax regulations create an uneven playing field for taxi cab companies. Jason Stein, the state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joins us now to give us the latest. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Good to be here.
So first, what kind of standards would this state bill impose on companies like Uber and Lyft?
Well, there'd be a whole range of standards, but what it would be is, you know, in a nutshell, they would need to pay licensing fees that would be nominal. They would need to have, you know, zero tolerance policies on drug and alcohol use, have background checks, insurance on rides and vehicles, and certain other steps. And, you know, in exchange, they would be able to go and work in any community in the state.
Right. That's the second part of this, that places like Milwaukee have tackled this issue. There's wrangling over regulations in Madison. Would localities be able to do anything apart from what the state does if this thing passes?
No, they would not. I mean, basically, municipalities could continue to have and enforce their much stricter rules, you know, in many cases, much stricter rules on taxi cab companies that already exist around the state, but would be preempted by the state. You know, the local governments would be preempted from doing anything to regulate ride-sharing services. So there would be, you know, a big inequality in some ways between, you know, in the regulations on taxi cabs and on ride-sharing companies.
Right now at the state level, is there any kind of regulation on ride-sharing, or is that just too new a phenomenon to have been tackled in the past?
At the state level, there is not. I mean, you know, this is one of the many examples that we see these days of elected officials, you know, whether at the state or local level, you know, struggling to catch up with, you know, a rapidly changing technology and a rapidly changing marketplace.
Talking to Jason Stein of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about efforts to have new statewide regulations on ride-sharing services, things like Uber and Lyft. Now, I want to talk about some various stakeholders and how they're reacting to this legislation so far, Jason. Let's start with the cities. Have local governments been up in arms over this, what would be a preemption of their ability to set local ordinances here?
You know, I think it's going to vary in part by what local government you're talking about and where they're at and how big they are. You know, certainly there's consternation among City of Madison and some Milwaukee officials because in the case of Milwaukee, the city has already adopted an ordinance to regulate ride sharing that is stricter than what's being proposed at the state level. And, you know, in Madison, they're contemplating regulations that would be much stricter than what is done at the that would be done at the state level. And, you know, as you know, it's become an issue in the mayor's race in Madison, actually.
And other communities, and I think this is from your reporting, I've seen this, there are some places saying, well, you know, we have almost little or no taxi cab service as it is. They're hoping these regulations would make it possible to have anything, in this case, in the form of Uber or Lyft.
Right. I mean, there is that element too. So, I mean, obviously, part of how you're going to look at this as an elected official or just as an ordinary person who may occasionally want to take public transportation, you'll look at it by what options exist right now. Now, you know, in fairness, there are taxi cab industry lobbyists and representatives that say, look, you know, even in rural areas, there are some shared ride services that exist right now and that, you know, are subject to local regulation right now. And if you approve this competition with a different set of regulations, how's that going to affect those existing services?
And, cab companies opposed to this regulation, as I understand it, or this new set of regulations. What's their case? Why do they think this is unfair to them?
You know, they're going to say, like in the case of Milwaukee, right now the city of Milwaukee does licenses individual drivers and does background checks on individual drivers, both cab and rideshare drivers. Going forward, they could continue to do those background checks on cab drivers themselves, but they no longer be able to do them directly on rideshare drivers. You'd have a situation where the rideshare companies would be doing those background checks and, you know, being responsible for vetting their drivers. I'll give you another example in a second, if you will, about disabled folks. So, you know, they've made the point that, you know, in some cases, local regulation requires taxi cabs to pick up the seeing eye dog for someone who is blind or visually impaired. You know, right now, under the bill, there would be clearly these ride-sharing companies would have to pick up ordinary passengers, you know, people of any kind. You know, they couldn't discriminate on the basis of race or ethnicity or what have you. It's not quite as clear from the legislation whether they would also have to take, you know, seeing eye dogs or, you know, maybe certain other items that are necessary to, you know, someone who has some kind of impairment.
And one complaint I've seen from taxi companies in the past is local regulations usually say they can't discriminate based on neighborhood or the part of town. Is that an issue that's addressed in this rideshare legislation?
That's a good question. In general, issues like that are not addressed. I can't speak to that specifically, but for instance, there's no requirement in this bill that rideshare companies offer 24/7 service. There is also, no prohibition against rideshare companies charging higher rates at peak hours. So if they want to charge a higher rate at a time when a sporting event is releasing people or at the time when bars close, that sort of thing, they would be free to do that.
Is there a timeline on when this bill would be taken up and voted on?
No, it doesn't, you know, appear to be fast-tracked or anything like that, but, I think it has some support and it has a pretty reasonable chance of passing right now. I mean, you know, we'll see. We haven't had a hearing yet, which is always a key thing to see for a bill.
Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jason Stein giving us the latest on newly proposed state legislation to regulate app-powered rideshare companies, talking about things like Uber and Lyft. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. American history is filled with the stories of the frontiersmen, but how about the frontiers women? In the early 1800s, at a time when a lot of the adventurers we hear about now were men, a woman named Juliet McGill Kinsey gave up a life of luxury out east to move to an outback town in what would later become Wisconsin. A new book in the Wisconsin Historical Society Press's Badger Biographies series traces Kinsey's life story to inspire a young generation of readers, especially girls. With us now is Kath Crowley Kahn. She's the author of Juliet Kinsey, Frontier Storyteller. Kath, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, so Kath came to Wisconsin at an interesting time. We'll get into some of the details in a bit, but one of the most remarkable things is she really realized it was an interesting time that she needed to tell the story of.
She certainly did. As you mentioned, she grew up in a very privileged household, very cultured, and was on track to become the ideal New England matron woman growing up. But when she was in her early teens, she received a letter from her uncle, who had a couple years earlier come out to what is now Chicago on the frontier, and he would write her these very detailed, very loving letters about his adventures out in the wild country, he would call it. And once she got a sense of what was out there beyond Connecticut, I think she had a taste for adventure.
And so what did she end up doing?
Well, it's very interesting. She did grow up in Connecticut and was schooled at home. Girls did not go to school back in those days, so she was taught by her mother and her uncle. And when she received this letter, she realized there was a little bit more than what was stated for her in New England. And so she went to a girls' finishing school, Miss Willard's in East Troy. And about that time, her uncle came back to Boston for a family visit and brought with him a new friend of his, John Harris Kinsey. Well, the two met, and as the family say, fell instantly in love and then got married. And so he had just taken a job out here in what is now Portage, Wisconsin, as the Indian agent. So she began to accompany him on this very amazing adventure from the East Coast out to Wisconsin.
And this was called, this was Fort Winnebago at the time.
It was Fort Winnebago. It was just constructed. It was probably still being constructed as they made their way over here.
Now, the journey in itself was interesting, but what were her first impressions of, I'll call it Wisconsin, even though it was part of the Northwest Territory at the time. What were the first things that struck her?
Well, you know, you did mention she's coming over on a boat. I don't know if we mentioned that, but this is part of the story. So her trip to Portage in Wisconsin is coming all via waterways. And she ends up towards the end of her trip coming towards Portage on the Fox River, and it swings back and forth, and she can see the fort in the distance, but it's taking them forever to get there. So once she gets to Fort Winnebago, she's overjoyed, and she goes up to the fort, which is on a precipice overlooking the river, and she looks down. It's fall color. It's a beautiful scene. There are white tents of the traders and other settlers. There are Indian lodges. There's a lot of activity going across the Portage, from the Fox River to the Wisconsin River. And it was a beautiful Eden. She saw it as this beautiful, untouched, wild land. Of course, there was much going on at that time. It was a very interesting time in our country's history, and she was there as an eyewitness to it all.
Now, this is 1830. She saw it as an Eden, and she met people she hadn't thought of much in Connecticut, the Ho-Chunk. What were her first impressions of that?
Well, that's very interesting. She came from Connecticut thinking that she was bringing everyone this giant gift of culture, refined manners, and religion. And she came to this area, met the Ho-Chunk, and embarked upon what she saw as her duty to educate everyone and share her religion and teach them to read. Well, she shortly found out that the Ho-Chunk had a complete belief system of their own and were quite happy with their beliefs and their culture, and she really respected that. So there was not only the physical journey of her moving from the East to the Midwest, but this emotional and intellectual journey as well, where she really learned to respect and value their culture.
We are taking a journey now back to about 18 years before Wisconsin became a state. 1830, our guest is Kath Crowley Kahn, and she's telling the story of Juliet Kinsey. Her new book is Juliet Kinsey, Frontier Storyteller. So Juliet quickly realized that this is a time of change, that the Ho-Chunk beliefs, the Ho-Chunk people were in for change and not necessarily for the better.
That's true. Today, when we look back at the writings that she wrote, she kept good notes, and she was a fantastic artist, so she would draw pictures of what she was experiencing at the time. And later on in her life, she took those notes and wrote a best-selling book at the time and still in publication, Wah Bun. Well, in the book, she talks about being so outraged at what was happening, and if our culture, if the U.S. government could just realize the impact that it's having, they would change their ways. We don't know whether she felt that way at the actual time, mm-hmm. but she certainly came to realize that with a very short period of time, maybe 20, 25 years, the way of life that she encountered when she first came here in 1830 was almost completely obliterated, and she was heartsick about it. Mm-hmm.
What letter to write about it? I mean, that's really the key. That's why we know what we know about her. That did she want to document this change? Was that what was foremost in her mind?
Well, it's funny because she was on her own keeping journals and notes as a proper cultured woman might of that time. But when she married into the Kinsey family, John Kinsey's mother took her aside and said, listen to what I'm saying. I'm going to paraphrase here. Write these things down as I tell you, because our children and maybe even strangers will be interested in the challenges and the delights of frontier life. So it was a family tradition to carry on the stories and document the stories about living on the frontier and their own family stories. And her version is a combination of that and her own experiences, and really represents a uniquely feminine perspective on that historical period in our country.
What was her life like in what is now Portage? What would daily life have been like for Juliet?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was walking here outside, and it's such a beautiful spring day here in Wisconsin. And you think of the frontier life, and, whoa, it would be great to be out on the in the prairie and walking through woods this time of year, and it probably was. But she actually came here in the fall of 1830 and encountered what meteorologists still call the winter of 1830. It was one of the most severe winters on record. And she would write about the wind coming through the boards in her cabin and freezing the water in the pitcher next to her bed solid in the morning. So it was an experience of really not taking for granted all the comforts that she might have had out east. It was, you had to be very resourceful and resilient. You had to provide for your own food, your own shelter. You had to encounter many different types of people. So you were very much in touch with survival, both in what they would call the settled areas as well as in the frontier and more wilderness areas, which she traveled through as well.
Now, she was here through a big moment in the history of the region, the Black Hawk, what we've called the Black Hawk War since then, anyway. What were her impressions of the Black Hawk War at the time?
Well, you know, it's fascinating because on one hand, she's very sympathetic to what's going on with the cultures, the Native American cultures. On the other hand, she's terrified for her life. And at one point, the scuttlebutt among the frontiersmen is that the warring Indians are moving closer and closer to Fort Winnebago and plan to slaughter everyone there. And so at that point, her husband decides this is too dangerous. We're shipping everyone out to Fort Howard in Green Bay for safety. And so she was heartbroken about that because she wanted to stay on the frontier and be brave with her husband. She and everyone else was worried about warfare as well as cholera at the time because that was coming from the other direction. So they really were feeling very vulnerable. But when she came back and heard the stories of what really was going on, the battle at Wisconsin Heights, the massacre at Bad Axe, she was heartbroken and wrote in detail about it in her book so that people would know and remember what actually happened.
And something I hadn't known, someone she might have crossed paths with at the fort, Jefferson Davis, later president of the Confederacy.
That's right. Jefferson Davis was at Fort Winnebago. In fact, he was the one who furnished her room. She had to stay at the fort until her house, which is currently up in Portage, was built. And he was known for being a very creative person and a bit of a cabinet maker architect. And of course, he went on to follow his own path. But it's interesting, in Juliet's life, she also crossed paths with Abraham Lincoln. Hmm. Because when she and her husband were living in Chicago, her husband was very involved with the administration. And she, in fact, many years later, pleaded with Abraham Lincoln to let her send provisions to her daughter who had relocated to Savannah. So he interceded on her behalf. So we've got a very interesting juxtaposition of personalities and people.
Juliet Kinsey told her story after her experiences in the 1830s. Why is it important to you now to tell her story to us?
Well, I think it's important to really understand where we live and the people who are here before us and what they encountered and saw. Julia Kinsey's a story of someone who comes into a new land not knowing whether she's going to survive, what if they're going to like her, and you know what her reception will be, and comes to it with with pluck, with resolve, with a sensitivity to other people. And I think that's the most important thing, is that don't be afraid to change your mind when you encounter the situation, respect the other people, and learn how to live peacefully with each other.
As we wrap up, she told the facts as she saw them. Do you have a sense of her personality, what she was like?
Boy, I wish I could meet her today. She was a hoot. She was very prim and proper, but had a just wicked sense of humor, and really was interested in people and how they related to each other, and the folly of manners sometimes. Everything that she was taught out east had a real different slant when she was out here on the frontier. So it was a fascinating thing. And her personality, if I can add, was one of the reasons why her daughter's daughter, Juliet Gordon Lowe, who founded the Girl Scouts, started the Girl Scouts to be resilient and resourceful.
That's an amazing story with roots here in Wisconsin. Kath, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
That's Kath Crowley Kahn. She's the author of Juliet Kinsey, Frontier Storyteller. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is back with me next week. Coming up later, we'll look at what the Green Bay area is doing to try to stem manure pollution and its impact on water in the region. First, the fast food giant McDonald's announced yesterday they're raising wages for nearly 90,000 of the company's employees. That means at corporate-owned stores, they'll set their minimum at a dollar above the local minimum wage. That doesn't include owners of franchise McDonald's, who will still set their own wages. Now, McDonald's is not alone. In the last few months, we've heard from a handful of major retailers, Walmart, Target, TJ Maxx, announcing raises for some of their lowest-paid workers. So what's behind this trend? Is it a trend? What sort of economic impact could this have? Joining us now to discuss these questions is Wally Hopp. He's Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Research at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Wally, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
So a big announcement for McDonald's, though. Critics point out that this doesn't affect franchise employees. But let's start with your reaction to this announcement yesterday afternoon.
Well, I think it's a terrific announcement. I see it as part of a larger trend. As you say, it's relatively few stores inside of McDonald's, but symbolically, I think it's significant. In particular, coming on the heels of the Walmart announcement, because that one is particularly significant since Walmart's the largest private employer in the U.S.
Now, there have been protests targeting, in particular, McDonald's and Walmart, saying, hey, raise your wages for low-end employees, and also saying states, hey, raise your minimum wages. Is this an issue where Walmart's and McDonald's are responding to bad publicity, or is this economic factors that have nothing to do at all with the protests?
I'd say it's both of those things and maybe a third thing that you didn't mention. So first of all, the basic economic reason is that the economic recovery has been taking hold for some years. It's been slow, but the improving employment numbers have been putting, finally, upward pressure on wages. So that's certainly there. The second one that you said is that there's been an increasing amount of public outcry against rising income inequality. And so, the sense that for the past few decades that the gains of the economy have been disproportionately going to the higher end of the income spectrum and leaving the lower end of the spectrum behind. And so, firms are getting negative publicity, from the Occupy movement to the, protests for, higher minimum wages. So that's certainly there, and firms have to worry about their image and their brand, and so I think that these increases are that as well. But the third one that I think is significant here is that there's an increasing amount of research and industry experience that provides evidence that paying high wages can actually save money. And the reason for that is it's an old story. Henry Ford described high wages as the smartest cost-cutting move he ever made. And the reason for that is that, you know, if you pay more to get more. If you pay higher wages, your employees stay longer. They, you know, learn their jobs better, and so they're more productive. You save the cost of having to recruit people to pay them. And if you pay better wages, you get, you know, better people applying for your jobs. And so the you know, sum of all those factors is that you wind up with more productive workers, and the productivity increase can often offset the you know, the cost of the higher wages.
Now, when I think of McDonald's in particular, it seems like that's a company that's been more about the process than the people, that they've got this smooth, mm-hmm. efficient machine mm-hmm. that, you know, the worker, after a quick bit of training, is more or less interchangeable. Does the quality of a worker, does the training of a worker and experience of a worker at McDonald's really make that much difference to their bottom line?
Well, you know, the as you say, the process is highly mechanized, right? So the idea is just to kind of, you know, make it as simple as possible so people learn it quickly and, you know, anybody can do the job. But that doesn't mean anybody does the job well. I mean, if you go into McDonald's, and, you know, take a look at how clean they are, or, you know, how friendly they are, or how responsive they are, right? There's a motivational impact that goes into this as well. And so that's an important piece of this productivity, you know, dimension. And it means that there's more to it than money. Here at the Ross School, we have a Center for Positive Organizations that studies the impact of the quality of the culture of an organization on the performance of the workforce. And what they find is that, you know, yeah, sure, higher pay helps, but so do better working conditions, and so does, you know, a sense of purpose in one's work. And all of those things kind of combine to, you know, elevate the level of motivation of the workforce, and, you know, leads to higher customer service and, you know, quality of the products the company produces.
Talking to Wally Hopp from the University of Michigan Ross School of Business about the news yesterday that McDonald's, for their direct corporate employees anyway, bumping up their wages for minimum wage workers, low-end workers, following on others, Target, TJ Maxx, and more. Mm-hmm. So, Wally, these wage increases, you're saying the benefits they could provide in terms of maybe morale for workers, the job performance they do, are enough to balance, maybe even exceed the cost?
Mm-hmm. I am saying that. That doesn't come automatically, right? You still have to execute. But one of the cases that business people like to look at is comparing Walmart, you know, say over the past 20 years with Costco. And average wages, you know, for the you know, hourly employees at Walmart were, say, call it $12 an hour. At Costco, it's around $22 an hour. Now, that's not a tiny gap. That's a gigantic gap. And these are both discount retailers playing, you know, very much in the same space. I mean, Sam's Club and Costco are going head-to-head with one another. But if you look at it, what Walmart's doing is they're hiring many employees who are relatively low productivity, whereas Costco is hiring fewer employees at much higher wages who are higher productivity, and they pay them better, not just better pay, but better benefits. You know, a much higher fraction of the Costco workforce has health benefits and retirement benefits. But if you look at it, you know, the turnover rate, you know, historically was maybe 44% per year at Walmart, maybe 17% at Costco. That's a big deal. You know, here now, the jobs are complex enough that, you know, learning does matter. If you have 44% of your people quitting every year, it's, you know, you got a lot of training going on, a lot of people who don't know their jobs. But Costco actually, you know, supplements their workers with very high efficiency operation systems. They deliver, you know, their products directly to the factory floor or to the retail floor. You know, they have a very efficient scheduling system. They keep the number of stock keeping units very low, and they set it up so that, you know, the fewer employees can be very, very efficient and then focus on, you know, customer service. And if you go there, you know, historically you'd see that the you know, Costco employees have more smiles on their faces than the Walmart employees do. But more importantly than all that is that if you look at the stock market performance and the profitability, Walmart's been the clear loser over the last couple decades. Costco has outperformed them in the market by a mile. And so, you know, I look at this a little bit as, you know, Walmart's been looking at Costco and, you know, saying, well, gee whiz, those guys pay a lot more money than we do, and they're doing really well. You know, we can probably afford to pay our workers, you know, better here and you know, achieve some of the same kinds of benefits that Costco's been able to achieve.
Are we starting to see a chain reaction going here where a huge employer like Walmart does this and then McDonald's thinks, well, that's partly our labor pool, and Target thinks the same thing, and so other people have to keep up with the Walmarts, the Waltons, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's that direct competition, you know, because, you know, you're looking at entry-level jobs here. So people are movable, right? They can swap around, and so there is some competition. But there's also a little bit of shaming going on, right? You don't want to be, you know, the Scrooge in the group, right? Is if everybody else is hiking up wages and you're left behind at the bottom, you're going to get that, you know, bad public image, as well as all the negative impacts of, you know, demotivated employees and so forth.
Why now, though? I mean, are suddenly companies waking up to what you're talking about positive business at the same time and deciding to pay more? Or is it because they can pay more and need to pay more to maybe attract people because the economy is improving?
I think the latter is probably the catalyst for this, you know, that the economy is improving, so it's the time to do it. But there's more to it. I mean, I just, you know, we just had a vice president from Walmart here speaking at the University of Michigan. And, you know, she talked about a significant culture change going on inside of Walmart. So it's not just higher wages that they were celebrating. It's also, you know, a significant investment in sustainability, you know, in terms of the suppliers that they buy from. And, you know, part of that's that's all kind of a piece, I think, you know, that they're trying to create a culture in which the employees are proud and satisfied to work at Walmart to a much greater extent than they have been before.
Yeah, how do they do that?
How do they cultivate that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're at a company that's basically saying, I mean, did you see the announcement this morning that the, you know, CEO of Walmart had protested anti-gay legislation in Arkansas? Now that's a pretty revolutionary thing for a, you know, pretty conservative retailer like Walmart to do. But they're basically, you know, now starting to flex their muscle a little bit because they are, you know, so big, and you know, do some things that you know, not only will attract employees but will attract you know, customers. And so the environment in which you work is particularly important now. Another factor besides just the rising economy is the entry of millennials into the workforce. What we're seeing here in the business school is a lot of research suggesting that millennials are particularly purpose-driven in their choice of employment. So when they're looking around, you know, amongst their various options, even a little bit of a change of this company's more socially responsible, this company's more sustainable, does influence their choices of places to work. So even employees that, you know, are at this level of, you know, sort of entry-level jobs in the retail industry are still influenced by, you know, the character, the environment, the values of the place that they work.
We're talking with business professor Wally Hopp about the handful of companies, including now McDonald's, that are opting to raise wages for some of their lowest paid employees. McDonald's just announced they'll set their starting wage at $1 above minimum wage at their corporate, their directly owned stores. What do you think? Do you see this as a step in the right direction, or do you think it'll ultimately cost you more as a consumer? And think back on your work career, whether we're talking about today or years ago. If you're a low-paid employee, does it make a difference, your working conditions, if you think you're being treated with dignity? If there's a purpose to the job you're doing, does that make a low wage more acceptable? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in a moment after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with University of Michigan business professor Wally Hopp about the handful of big name companies, including McDonald's, that are opting to raise wages for some of their lowest paid employees. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts. Do you think this is a step in the right direction? Good for the economy? Something that could raise prices for you as a consumer, as a worker, or maybe as an employer? Do you think better paid employees do a better job? Do you think it helps keep them on the job longer so you don't have to keep training new people all the time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to the calls, Wally, is public image more important now for companies than ever to where they're worried about what the public thinks about what they pay their employees?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, this is something that the marketing research field has been looking at, and it's a pretty dramatic change just in the past couple of years. What they do is they measure the value of brands, and brands that are associated with sustainability and social responsibility are numerically more valuable than ones that aren't. And so these are hardcore marketing people on Madison Avenue and so forth that are urging companies to work on their reputation in these areas. So the kinds of steps that Walmart has taken in the sustainability space, many of them are cost-saving things, right? If they use nitrogen-filled tires or auxiliary power units on their trucks and save energy, it's good for the planet, but it's also good for their bottom line. But it's also now good for their brand image. And that a decade ago, that really wasn't true. That, you know, being associated with, you know, sustainability or social responsibility was, you know, appealing to a very small segment of the population. But, you know, I think, again, as the millennials are, you know, becoming a bigger and bigger part of the, you know, consumer public, it's becoming more important as an element in a corporate brand.
Go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Kevin with us in Kewaskum. Kevin, hi.
Hi there. I guess I got, I think it's great, and I think it's great for these companies' images, and I guess I want to pose a question, and maybe this is going out on a limb, but is this maybe an example why we don't need to have a minimum wage that it'll take care of itself? And I can take my answer off the air.
Kevin, interesting question. Wally, what do you think?
Kevin, I think that's a great question. You know, maybe it is that social pressure can take, you know, the place of a mandatory minimum wage. The concern I have, though, is that, you know, it may not go far enough. The companies that are particularly concerned about their brand, you know, like a Walmart, you know, a McDonald's, because they are in the public eye, are going to be pressured by, you know, social protest. But the smaller, you know, companies that are out of the public eye aren't going to feel that. And there are lots and lots of those. So I think that there still is a role for a minimum wage. And if you look at it, the minimum wage in real buying power has gone down and down and down, right? It would be significantly higher than the $10 or, you know, whatever that people are talking about increasing it if it had just kept up with inflation. So the kinds of changes that have been argued for in the minimum wage are ones that I think are pretty modest and you know, wouldn't have much of a negative impact on the economy and might have a pretty positive impact on a pretty significant slice of the workforce.
Kevin, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Catherine in Racine. Catherine, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What did you want to bring up, Catherine?
I wanted to make a comment that if you are satisfied in your job, if you are valued as an employee, a low wage can be justifiable. I used to work at a bus driver for a daycare center that was employed by S.C. Johnson, the Johnsons who produced Windex, Blade, Skrillin Bubbles, so on and so forth. This is an international company, and even though I was only bringing home 800 net, I loved my job. I would, if I could, I would go back in a heartbeat, even though the wage can't support myself and my son, because I was treated so well and I was so valued as an employee.
Catherine, can I ask a personal question? How old are you?
I am 25. I'm a millennial.
Okay. Well, I was interested. I was wondering about that, Catherine. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. So is this, Wally, a story we're hearing from millennials? We can maybe get by without tons of money as long as we are into what we're doing?
Yeah. Survey after survey shows exactly what Catherine just said. That dignity in and purpose in work matters to them, and they, the millennials, to a greater extent than older people like me, are willing to sacrifice some wages in order to get that. So it's a value shift on the part of that generation, and I think an admirable one, but it's one that corporations are standing up and taking notice of.
Catherine, thanks for that call. We're talking to Wally Hopp from the University of Michigan about wage increases at Walmart, McDonald's, Target, elsewhere. Wally, is this making a virtue out of necessity, though? Is it that the high-paying jobs maybe aren't out there? They're not as available for millennials, so they're making the best with what they've got?
Well, that may be the case, right? And so maybe it is that we're entering an era of lower economic growth. And maybe economic growth isn't necessarily the best measure of success of an economy. There are some European countries that measure gross net happiness instead of gross net product, or gross national product. What they do is they try to measure other factors that influence the quality of life. It's dignity on the job and a sense of self-worth and satisfaction contribute to that. That seems like a pretty reasonable thing to me, whether it's, forced out of necessity or whether it's, a real, value choice. It seems like not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay. If I'm a stockholder, though, at a big company, when I look at the year-end statement, I'm not looking for dignity and happiness. Right. I'm looking for the bottom line. Are people like that, our stockholders, our business owners, seeing the dignity you're talking about, the workplace quality of life, translating, are they getting the message you're trying to send, that these things pay off for them in the long run?
Well, they are. In some sense, if you look at it, that some of these things, paying low wages, getting bad, publicity, being an irresponsible citizen in society and so forth, confers risk on the companies, right? You get boycotts, you get, lawsuits, et cetera. So there are lots of things that having a positive business strategy, serves as a risk mitigation measure. And what we've been studying here at the Ross School is lots and lots of cases. If you go to our Center for Positive Organizations site, you'll see case studies and research papers and surveys and so forth that show that there are many businesses out there that are producing a better bottom line, better returns to their shareholders by means of investing in their workforce and investing in socially responsible business practices. So it's not, even if the shareholders don't care a whit about the planet or the employees, these are good business practices if you want to make money sustainably over the long term.
So we've seen, as we mentioned, the headlines about Walmart's, McDonald's, and others. Are there a lot of other shoes waiting to drop? Do you think we're going to be seeing more big companies raise their wages at some level for their lowest wage employees?
Yeah, I would expect so. I mean, Walmart's the largest retailer. They've gone there. So I think that the rest of the retail industry is under more pressure, than they were just a short time ago. McDonald's, even though, the franchisees aren't bound by this decision, is a big and highly visible player in the fast food industry. So again, there's a measure of pressure on that industry. Hotel and service industries are sort of another frontier where I'm sort of watching to see if a big player will make a move.
We'll watch along with you and maybe talk to you about this again. Wally, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Wally Hopp. He's Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Research at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Join us to talk about the new raises for many McDonald's employees, following on similar raises at Walmart's and other big employers around the country.